Okay, good morning and welcome to another enthralling episode in our webinar series. Today we're focusing on humans and our humans, and specifically human risk management. And we're joined today by our partner, KnowBe4, who are leaders in this space, so definitely the right people to be assisting us with. And I'll come on to our panelists a little bit later. We've seen human risk exploited in numerous breaches, and actually many of those breaches, particularly when it comes to phishing, targeting our end users, which is especially concerning as we've seen since the advent of ChatGPT, an over 4,000% increase in phishing emails targeting people, trying to trick them and coerce them into behaviors that perhaps they wouldn't. But human risk isn't entirely one-dimensional. It's not just about phishing. And also needs to go well beyond security awareness training. And it's also clear and important to factor in that it's not one size fits all, and it needs tailoring either to our organization, our users, and also in our preventions and interventions. But as with all things security, the solution has to involve people, process, and technology, and that's what we're going to cover: human risk and how each one of those elements fit together. So let me introduce our, if I can get the slides just to pop on there. So let me introduce our panel for today. So firstly, I'm going to welcome Dr. Martin Kramer. So Martin is the security awareness advocate for Europe and the Middle East at KnowBe4, promoting cybersecurity as a keynote speaker, researcher, and lecturer. Human-centered security and artificial intelligence are at the core of his activities. Martin has been active in the industry and research for more than 10 years, earning his doctorate to the University of Oxford and working as a consultant for SAP. I apologize for any background noise. Second, we have my colleague, Brian Martin. Brian is Director of Product Management at Integrity 360, responsible for managing and developing Integrity 360's group portfolio of cybersecurity services and solutions. Brian has extensive experience in his career across IT, software development, and telecoms, with over 10 years' focus purely on cybersecurity in all its aspects, including related technology services, processes, and best practice. So very much got an expert panel today to help us walk through what is going to be a fireside chat. So no slides today, but we're going to talk through some of the key aspects throughout the next half an hour or so. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen so that we can kick off today's fireside chat. If I can find the right button, there we go. But just lastly, as a quick reminder, we have the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. So please use that to ask questions throughout, and we will cover those at the very end in our Q&A session. So the first place to start, I think, is very much with a poll. So Lisa, if you could fire our first poll off, please. And we'll give you, 20 to 30 seconds just to fire your answers in. And I think it will give us a great starting point. Yeah, so we're going to start looking at, what is your concern when it comes to the human factor as part of your security posture? Okay, hopefully we've got a few people that have replied to the poll. Lisa, if you'd like to close that off and we can have a very quick look at the results. Okay, well, the results are in, and unsurprisingly, there's very few that have said not concerned. Thankfully, none that have said that humans are not a factor in our security posture, because they are an important part, as clearly we're all aware. Probably it'd be great to talk to that person that has said that they're not very concerned, and most of their users are security aware, and particularly probably off the back of this as well. But it's important to see that actually most people are in the same boat. Either they are very concerned. Now I've a bit of a trick answer there, saying that users are the weak link. We probably shouldn't look at them as the weak link, and very much our first line of defense. Or they're somewhat concerned. Some of our users get it, but it's clear that across the board, whether it's the breaches we've seen or just experience in our own organizations, that that we need to invest in our people and assist our people to be as secure as possible. So I don't know if Martin or Brian, any comments there on that those poll results and actually what you guys are seeing across industry?
Yeah, I would say I'm very happy. If I can jump in first, I'm very happy to see, of course, that people are picking up on the topic. It's a very important recognition that we also see in industry reports, the Verizon Data Breach Investigations report, for example. Over the past years, if not even decades, has always shown that the human element in cybersecurity is one to be focused on, as it contributes to more than 60%, sometimes more than 70% of all data breaches. So I'm very happy to see that among the participants here today, there's a big recognition of that fact.
Yeah, excellent. So that really kicks us into, I guess, our first question or our first talking point, which is really setting the scene and why now? Why are we talking about this? So, Martin, I'll probably stay with you as to kick this off as you were first to reply. But the human factor has long been acknowledged as a security challenge. But why is human-centric security gaining traction now?
Yeah, I think I kind of stated already the stats for that. Some reports will tell us 60%, 70%, some go as far as 90%. It is a huge contributing factor to the data breaches that organizations experience. So that's been the case for the past 15 years or so, or even since we really are concerned with security. And I think finally we are at a point where where the industry, where organizations are, after all, ready to acknowledge that it cannot be easily, quotes unquotes, off fixed, that it cannot be just easily addressed with raising awareness and instilling knowledge. For quite some time, and I'm taking a very reflective look into the mirror here. For quite some time, us cybersecurity experts just have assumed, well, we have that additional knowledge, we have that edge, which is why we behave securely and the rest of the world and all of the employees don't. Of course, that if that was the case, we would have educated everyone by now and we would have addressed this issue. So we can no longer say that employees, the workforce, is the weakest link, users are the weakest link. That's just wrong. So I think what has happened now is that we are at a point where we recognize really it's the combination of ever-evolving technology. We can think about artificial intelligence, we can think about more IoT devices, industry 4.0, et cetera. So all of these trends, smart cities, whatever we have. So technology is always evolving. And then also our use of that technology evolves. So basically, I can go back in time when we started using mobile phones, that was new to us. Now it's AI that is new to us. So there's always something that is new to us, which is how the world works, to put it bluntly. But it also means that we are constantly trying to keep up the pace. And that means that people, cyber criminals, have the chance of, exploiting our uncertainty, of playing at our desire to learn, playing at our psychology. And I think social engineering has been such a big topic, that's been, a challenge for many organizations to deal with for such a long time. And finally, we are at that point, I mentioned it, where we recognize what really actually matters is how people behave, rather than what they know or what they think. So it doesn't matter what the new technology is that we're dealing with. It doesn't matter what we know about it. What really matters is how people behave. In social engineering, the goal of the attacker is always to make people behave in the way that benefits the attacker. And of course, as on the defensive side, as organizations, we always want to make sure that people behave securely or as secure as possible in the interest of us, of our organizations. So that fairly long story to tell right now, but that's where we are. And I could give you one or two examples, of course, how that looks like today.
Yeah, no, I don't. We'll come on to that in a second. I think there's a few important points you made there. One was about actually, the security guys, expecting everybody else to have the same knowledge. I'd actually also argue that, I'd say people in security don't always actually know best, or when it comes to behaviors, follow those exact behaviors, being, considering not above the law, but maybe complacency from time to time. And definitely, there is a technology element to any solution. As you say, technology is hugely evolving. Always new things for us to get to grips with. You mentioned AI. The next thing purported to be around the corner is quantum computing, and what effect that's going to have, and how that changes our approach. But yeah, I couldn't agree more that behavior is much more important than knowledge. And I think we are going to discuss that in a little bit more detail. But I'll come back to you in a second for some of those use cases. Brian, I'll just come to you just quickly on, it's something that Martin mentioned there in terms of, social engineering. And really, I don't know if you've got a view on exactly, how that's become so effective. I know that we, we had a session with Dr. Fox Hamilton not too long ago, but she gave some great insights.
I think that, what has changed to make that happen? And I think there are a combination of factors. I mean, first of all, the workplace has changed dramatically in recent years with so many more people working and collaborating remotely and digitally. And a lot of the social engineering techniques, it work particularly effectively when they're over a digital medium. So just the whole attack surface, if you like, for that type of attack has increased dramatically because of that process. And then secondly, with the advent of artificial intelligence and deepfakes and the ability of AI to improve the quality of social engineering attacks, whether they be, messaging or email or other media, that just has turbocharged, if you like, the attacker side in terms of their capabilities to target this increased footprint of digital communications across the modern enterprise. So I think it's, that humans have the same susceptibilities to being socially engineered and have the same motivations that cause them to react in certain ways. But because now there's dramatically more people working in that type of environment with the increased arsenal that the attackers have, that has made the problem worse. And it was interesting in the survey, on the one hand, we were happy to see people still concerned about human security being a factor and taking it seriously. On the other hand, it is an indictment that maybe, it's a problem that we haven't cracked and probably, never will completely, and therefore need to remain continuously vigilant on an ongoing basis.
Well, I wouldn't be so negative, Brian. We're going to, put the world to rights when it comes to human security in the next 20 minutes or so. So I mean, social engineering, like playing upon people's fears, creating urgency, authority, and actually, Martin, you had a great example of this that kind of aligns with that deep fake example that that Brian was giving.
So this is a story of a social engineering incident that happened, I think, early last year at the Hong Kong branch of the British engineering firm Arup. I'll tell the story before explaining some of the insides of it. So basically, we are going we are taking the perspective of a worker from the finance department who goes about their day as they normally would. And they receive, of course, a lot of emails, but one of these emails stands out. It's an invitation to a call where urgent financial matters are to be discussed. The topic is an upcoming merger. And as part, of that meeting, the finance worker notices that senior management is involved, and even the CFO is to be is to participate in the meeting. So at the time of the meeting, of course, they dial in. We don't know whether it was Zoom, Teams, or any of the other platforms, but that also doesn't matter all that much. So they find themselves surrounded by senior finance officials and essentially are at this point listening to a very sort of targeted discussion as to what decisions have to be taken to secure the future of the firm, specifically by making these financial decisions that are coming up. The details of the conversations are not known. They have not been published, but it must have been a quite targeted conversation. So at the end of that meeting, the finance worker leaves the meeting, then following it, receives several emails with payment instructions and carries out a total of 17 transactions to, I believe, seven different, no, sorry, 15 transactions to seven different bank accounts. And it's only that after these 15 transactions, they get a little bit suspicious and decide to ring up the CFO and double check whether this amount of money, this number of transactions was actually what they intended to do. And the CFO then immediately says, "Oh no, we are actually being defrauded here." And that's when the Hong Kong police gets involved. The story that I've told is basically based on a report by again a senior management that teamed up with the World Economic Forum to share this story. And they shared this story for the particular reason that in that online meeting, no one else was sitting in live or in real time in front of the camera but that poor victim, that finance worker. Everyone else, so several other people, were actually pre-recorded deepfake videos. So, keep in mind this is early last year. At that point, the deepfakes were pre-recorded. So that finance worker was essentially watching an elaborately staged theater play, if you want so. Now, of course, that's problematic because deepfakes were not spotted because there was no policy that essentially, would have told him to stop and verify what we so often say when we are educating our users. If anything is suspicious, you should probably stop and verify. It took 15 transactions for them to pick up the phone and ring up the CFO to do that. Should have happened earlier. So there's a number of learnings here, and that's important to recognize. Now, one particular thing I just want to say also is, because I know it's highly relevant even these days, deepfakes these days, they also happen in real time. So we cannot just assume they are pre-recorded, but they will happen in real time. So it's very important to educate people how to spot them and how to react. So it's about training. I already mentioned there should have been a policy in place. And of course, we also always have to think about the right technology, which overall brings us to this comprehensive approach. That we these days have to think about in order to keep the upper hand.
Yeah, no, indeed. And that was probably quite an awkward conversation or phone call to the CFO. But as you say, let's move on to looking at that change that we need to make. And John Martin, I might stay with you on this one. So I mean, I suppose there's two parts to this question as we look to really move between that traditional into more complete and behavioural based. But traditional awareness campaigns and traditional approaches that focus on just security awareness, as we've kind of touched upon, are so ineffective. But I think firstly, it'd be great to get some comment on that. But also, what's the difference that we need to take and approach to go from awareness to that real behavioural change?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned over the years, it's been consistent that the majority of all data breaches had an element of human behavior in it. And so the things that we have tried was instilling knowledge. I've mentioned that. But we really hadn't gotten to grips with the fact that even if the knowledge was like highly specific to a specific to a particular requirement, say, whether that's a payment security standard, whether that's a data protection standard, whether that's specific to a role, however specific it was, it really didn't do the job at the end of the day. So in full recognition now, finally, that knowledge is not the same as behavior, or even intention is not the same as behavior, we have moved on. So in psychology, this is known as the intention behavior gap that we have to bridge. That is reflected also in people admitting that despite better knowledge, they behave insecurely. Or to put this in numbers, Gartner ran a survey also in 2023, I believe already, where they asked people, okay, have you ever breached a security policy, although you knew to follow it? And people said, yes, I have. And there's a number of reasons. But And a number of reasons might be it's too impractical, it's too much effort. I just need to get the job done. You can imagine some of the typical answers. But another one was, they also said if the tools and the security requirements that I need to meet would just be easier to achieve, or if the tools would just be better to use, then perhaps I would be more likely to follow the policy. So that's where we begin to see that really what we have to bring together is the right training, yes, because we need to trigger behavior. But in order to move from intention to behavior, we also need to make it easy enough. There's a number of ways how we can look at it, but I like to often use a model by the behavioral scientist BJ Fogg, who simply says, in order for behavior to occur, you need to have the right level of motivation, you need to have the right level of ability, and you need to have a trigger. So motivation we can achieve through training. Ability, of course, we can facilitate by making it easy, and a trigger we can achieve through, anything like say a banner on top of an email or a poster on the wall, or people can self-motivate and self-trigger, etc. So that's where we need to go, and that's where the industry now is going.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I think from that study, it was 93% said that they would take an action, even though they knew it put the enterprise at risk. Which is pretty amazing statistic. I think obviously you're correct in terms of the motivation, the intent, and actually turning that into action is going to be the challenge. And Brian, I think if I can just come to you on the effectiveness of security awareness and how Martin talked about the banners, putting the odd poster up to try and make people aware. But we also see sometimes organizations holding people up on you failed this phishing account, or you had insecure behaviors to almost make an example. But I'm not sure that really is the way forward.
Yeah, because in fact, if you instigate a blame culture, then in fact you start to encourage the wrong behaviors, which is to hide mistakes that have been made, or to people to feel, insecure around, all of this type of activity. So if you really want to change behaviors, you need to move away from, as Martin says, not just being aware of what the right thing to do is, and to actually change how you behave, how you operate, and the decisions you make. And the communications around this needs to be supportive, not punitive. Needs to change that tone. You need to do it by having respected leaders exemplify the behaviors you expect in everyone. You need to reward the heroes, not punish the guilty, if you like. And even reward people who did make a mistake, but then, fessed up to it and made the right decision. Be very positive about that too. Because you want to remove any friction from people for, feeling that they can't report something or admit they've made a mistake. And then everybody can collectively learn from those mistakes as well. We've seen some innovative companies do also fun things, things like gamify the whole learning process and behavior process. We've had clients who've run things like escape rooms where you had to, solve security awareness and training puzzles in order to get out of the escape room. We've also seen other companies that have actually hired marketing professionals into the security team to help bolster the messaging out to the wider organization around good behaviors and things to be aware of as well. So there are other ways to do it than just to use a kind of a hectoring kind of negative approach to blaming people for making mistakes.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although a lot of that sort of marketing into security teams is still about awareness and bringing that to the forefront. Martin, you sort of mentioned the making controls frictionless, and I often think about the concept of desire paths. There's the path you should be on, but then there's a shortcut that you could take, and we see people using that over and over again. But I suppose Brian teases up nicely there, talking about being supportive, not punitive. In our approach. So, it kind of begs the question, how do you design, a security program that that encourages that secure behavior? What is the key?
Best way to look at it, I think, is to look at organizations who get it right, who say that, they have seen a significant decrease in their risk profile. They say, sorry, that did not make sense. They say that they have seen a significant decrease, in insecure behavior, and therefore have a better risk profile that is more manageable. So what we can do is we can look at another report. The World Economic Forum published a report earlier this year. They always do it in collaboration with the security consultancy Deloitte recently. So what they see and what they report on in there is that organizations who self, you know, although self-attest, but that's okay, who say they are more cyber resilient, they make strategic investments. And they do invest in awareness training, of course. But beyond that, and that's the crucial point, they invest into instilling secure behaviors. So they have security champions programs. They also have real-time coaching that is facilitated through software. They have non-punitive policy. We just touched on it. They even go as far, some of them even go as far as establishing a KPI for reporting incidents or insecure behaviors, etc. And they instill a positive security culture around everything they do through these measures. So that means that really these organizations that succeed instill a culture of proactive security behavior. And that is that signal that shows in several different other ways. So it also shows in if you would ask a random employee, they would say, "Oh, security, that's also my responsibility." They wouldn't say any longer, "Security, that's the responsibility of the InfoSec team," or let alone the IT department or the responsibility of the CISO. No, there's a recognition that security permeates the business, and therefore every single person in the enterprise has to take accountability and has to take responsibility of their own security behaviors. So that's a crucial part of it.
And it has to be driven from the very top. I think it's one thing saying, "Joe, that's the responsibility of the security department. Actually, I'm going to take on that accountability." But behavioral change in organization has to come from the very top. And I often think about it and taking a leaf out of the oil and gas industry. Now, not so much about security awareness, but in terms of safety. Obviously, they've had some numerous tragedies that were down to human error that they've seen, and actually created a culture of where nobody's afraid to call somebody out for unsafe behaviors, to assist their colleagues. Even things like not holding the handrail when going down the stairs on an oil rig, or being walking on your mobile phone. Simple things like that that people are very comfortable to just remind their colleagues that actually, that's a behavior that we shouldn't exhibit. And I think that's something that we've got to instill in organizations. You say there's tools that ongoing coaching, even as I saw, talking to somebody at IT Web down in South Africa, around the use of AI, being able to take the load off of doctors during training other doctors, because they haven't got the time to go around and individually train and coach everybody. So putting tools in place that can enable that coaching ongoing to create those behaviors. So I think just an interesting time, we'll move on to really talk looking at human risk management and what the strategy is. So Lisa, we've got another poll here if you would like to launch that poll for us. Thank you very much. So a poll on human risk management and the strategy around it. So, how mature is do you consider your human risk management strategy? So we have the options there are very mature. We have a clear strategy covering all aspects of human risk. We have mature. We have a defined strategy covering most aspects and which we report on regularly. Somewhat mature. So we have a human risk strategy, but it's not particularly well defined. Doesn't cover all aspects, particularly what we've talked about thus far. And/or is implemented ad hoc. Not mature. Our human risk strategy is not well defined. Or lastly, what is a human risk strategy? So hopefully nobody's clicking that last one. But do be honest. So I'll just give another 10 to 15 seconds for people to respond to the poll, and then we can have a look at the answers and our response from that, and then we can dive down into human risk management. There we go. We should see the results pop up. But thankfully, nobody has ticked the what is human risk strategy. We've got some that looking very mature, have that clear strategy covering everything that we've talked about thus far and is governed and constantly refined. A good number with a mature human risk management strategy, but then also equally almost half there, just over half, somewhat and not mature. So Brian, I don't know what sort of I guess there's some good insights to take from that, and some comfort I guess from some of the respondees.
Yeah, it's a broad coverage from the the 11% who are mature right down to a lot of people in that middle category where somewhat are making some progress but not not as far as they would potentially would like. I think that's I think that's points to the fact that this, I think, can never be completed. It's almost a continuous process. I see human security in the context of the wider threat exposure management, and as we know, including human security into threat exposure management is a good way to think about it, because what you're thinking about is threat actors leverage different exposures in order to ultimately achieve their goals. Might start with a social engineering phishing attack to gain access to a privileged account, or then move laterally within the organization. So really, it needs to be your human security needs to be considered in that light. And Gartner has a good model around managing that on a continuous basis, thinking about first of all, scoping, what you want to include in your scoping, where you have doing discovery about what your current risk profile is. Who are the risky users, and then going through that cycle of prioritization, validation, and your mobilization then is really a combination of increased awareness and training, along with the tooling and processes to make you more secure. And then if you consider that as part of a continuous process, then you'll always be adding to it, improving it, maybe retiring bits that are less relevant and keeping up to date with the ongoing threat landscape. So I think that survey is a reflection of the fact that, you must constantly evolve your human risk strategy and approach in order to remain current in the current environment.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. We've got to get visibility of what is just another exposure, another risk to be able to quantify that. Martin, if we look, talk about a human risk management strategy, what does that look like for you? How do you integrate that into the wider security strategy? I know we've touched upon some elements now, but already, but really, how would you define a human risk management strategy?
Yeah, that's a good question. Basically, it is an overall perspective that complements your, if you want, a governance, risk, compliance, your GRC function, or it complements even your enterprise risk management, to include any and everything that's to do with human behavior and your risk exposure in your organization. So that is the first part. Second part is it's not only meant to monitor, but also to manage. So when we are thinking about managing, we have to think about different interventions. Now, we know, looking at risk management, that fundamentally in cybersecurity, we're dealing with people, process, and technology measures. Meaning, if I take this perspective, any high risk that I've identified, I can address with, working or address or using the people lens, using the technology lens, or using the policy lens. It's always a product of that. So that means I have to bring all of, the people who are involved in all of these different measures to the same table. So that's a shortcut of me saying human risk management is a sort of board level responsibility. It needs to have the visibility of really senior leadership, because at the end of the day, this is where business risk is owned, and it is an essential part of that business risk. So I don't just have to say that because it makes us sound more important. We can look at, regulation. We can look at, over in Europe, we have the critical infrastructure regulation, NIS2. Of course, in the UK, we have the equivalent of that also. We have DORA as for the financial institutions. And again, we have, or even the Data Protection Act over here, et cetera, GDPR, et cetera. So we don't really have to look very far to see that more and more regulation forces boards to be responsible and partly even to be personally liable for cybersecurity decisions. And as that is the case, many of these regulations put it in writing that, the human element is a crucial part of it, which, is then a strong motivator to say, hey, we need to take this holistic perspective at human risk management. Now, I've already alluded to the fact this isn't just about training. This is also about technical measures, and it's also about policy. And I just want to illustrate this a little bit further. So think about the number of emails your employees receive every single day, right? A certain proportion of that emails will actually be malicious emails. Now, what do you do to deal with them? Well, you already have, email security in place. You already train your users, and you already have written the policy that tells them if anything is suspicious, you should report it. Now, if you want to improve on this situation, because I guarantee you a certain amount of email will always go through the technical defense, will always reach the user, a certain amount of users will always not take the desirable decision, then you again have to invest in all of these three aspects. Again, you should bring this, or you should bring your email security to the next level. You should make sure that people are well educated and well aware of the threats, that they are also trained to behave securely, and you should make sure that your policies stay up to date. Now, this means that you need to maintain, that you need to monitor, that you need to evaluate, that you need to manage, and that you need to be able to audit your entire system. So that's where really human risk management comes in.
Yeah, I think it's so important. Yeah, you mentioned email security as being, part of that, obviously in the face of phishing activity, but also in terms of, monitoring behavior, through inboxes to be able to guide, what training is needed, what behaviors do we need to alter, in order to make ourselves much more secure. So Brian, just I think there's that growth. You've, I suppose we touched upon this a little bit, but see that growing focus on empowering employees to be, very much part of that defense and not just a risk to manage. So what's your view on, following on from what Martin said, in building, this culture of shared responsibility?
So I think it's about empowerment, explain the why. I think if you want to change behaviors, if you want to empower people, they need to understand the why. And the most powerful way to do that is through stories, storytelling with real examples. And so I think that's a really important part of the communications is around getting people to really understand the, why this is so important. As mentioned before, respected leaders exemplifying the behaviors, reward your heroes and good behavior in general. The positive reinforcement rather than the blaming and hectoring, as we talked about before, and also removing the barriers as well. There are negative situations that cause individuals to ignore what they know is the right thing. That can be fatigue, overwork, cynicism. So creating time and space for people to actually do the right thing, learn the right thing, make it fun and positive. And just that positive reinforcement. And I think the in the longer term, personalization as well. I think we've all been on the receiving end of rehashed training that is feels like it's duplicated, that it's repetitive, and we're not relearning anything new. So the ability for the tools and the processes to actually target relevant content to the relevant people and personalize it more, rather than washing everybody with the same content all the time, I think can play a big role as well.
Brilliant. And John, we are getting on for time, so I've probably got two questions. One, a bit of a step change into everyone's favorite topic at the moment, and that's AI. So Martin, just obviously there's been big strides, as you mentioned at the very start, how technology is changing, and people need to get to grips with it, but actually how can we utilize it, whether it's AI agents, agentic AI, making use of generative AI capabilities. So I suppose a two-part question or two-prong question. Does agentic AI and AI in general, do you see it tipping the scales for attackers or defenders? And then secondly, what does it really do for human risk management?
So it does not tip the scales to answer that question straight away. And I say that because AI, at the end of the day, as long as we do not have super intelligence, meaning we do not have AI that's smarter or more intelligent than we are as humans, we have to assume that we are to some extent still in control. So that means cyber criminals will always favor or will always be able to work around the technology using the same technology or using other technology and attack the human. That's number one. And the second point is, the end of the day, cyber criminals always only have to go for the lowest hanging fruit, the easiest access in. So if the technology gets better, that means they get more interested in attacking the humans, just working around the technology again. So that may suggest, you may now think, well, then, it really tips the scales for the attackers. No, I wouldn't still say so, because defending meant finding sometimes, the needle in the haystack, whereas attacking meant you only have to find, one way in, and there's so many different doors. Now, when a AI comes in, particularly agentic AI, that is able to work towards a specific goal autonomously, you can imagine that these AI agents can be very helpful in keeping your organization secure, because they can do a lot of tedious, a lot of resource intense background work. So with AI in cybersecurity defense, we have a great opportunity to really solidly strengthen our defenses. And that's required because, with the AI on the attacking side, certainly sophistication will grow. And certainly, and we have observed this already in in human-related security, the quantity of attacks and the quality of attacks will grow. So for human risk management, that means we are now able to create more personalized, more relevant, and more adapted training for people. At the end of the day, the training is the more successful, the more relevant it is for people. So you can imagine training can be customized by AI, but it can also be delivered just in time. For example, if I have just sent, sorry, if I've just opened an email that is suspicious, I can be prompted to think whether I should report it or not. If I have just plugged in a USB stick, which I shouldn't have done, I can be guided through a sort of remedial training, or at least be reminded of what the corporate policy was, that is not to plug in a USB stick. So with AI, we have the ability in the background to process large amounts of cyber security related events and incidents and turn those into training moments, into teachable moments. And that is one aspect where human risk management can benefit hugely.
Yeah, brilliant. So I'll tell you what, in the as we're hard up on time, I'm going to give you both a quick question. I say quick, could be a longer answer. Looking ahead, looking forward when it comes to human-centric security. I'll keep on with yourself, Martin. How do you see, or where do you see human-centric security evolving to over the next few years?
I see organizations benefiting from threat intelligence, whether that is threat intelligence that comes out of, the own organization, because, the workforce, all of the workforce is reporting incidents, is reporting suspicious emails, etc., or whether that is threat intelligence from outside that they subscribe to because it's relevant to their industry or relevant to organizations of their size. I see organizations making use of agentic AI for their own defense, whether that's for personalizing content, for incidents triage, or for keeping the network secure. And I see organizations fully evolving to the point where cybersecurity and human risk management is a CEO board level kind of concern.
Brilliant. And Brian, I'll give the last word to yourself before we jump into the Q&A.
So I agree wholeheartedly with Martin's summary there. I would just add maybe I see more integration, rather than standalone silos of capability, more integration of signals coming from the training and awareness platforms, integrating with email, endpoint, DLP, security service edge, all providing more tailored risk assessments and remediations, and ability to get visibility at risk at a user level as well as at an organizational level. And as I mentioned before, integrating that into your wider threat exposure management. And also the more automation of the testing side of the campaigns, integrating more of the modern attack types like automation of campaigns involving deepfakes, agentic AI, but tailored and personalized as well to individuals and different parts of the organization.
Yeah, I think definitely from a technology perspective, wholly across security, we see a convergence as all the different elements come together for a fuller, not just portfolio, but joined up capability, whether that's single vendor, multi vendor, but it's all got to pull together in one area. So I will jump on to the Q&A. So let's jump in. If I can just find my Zoom window, which has just disappeared off my screen. Where are we? 2 seconds. So let's have a look at the Q&A, which has just disappeared. Classic. Here we go. Okay, so we've got a couple of questions in. Please do ask any questions that we can put to the panel. So the first question is, how should I approach this to get board or exec level buy-in? So I guess this is really a question, Martin, of how do you manage upwards?
Yeah. Straight away, I would say storytelling is a great example. I just mentioned that perhaps the most powerful story that you could imagine have, which is the social engineering attack that Arup was a victim to, because that involved the CFO being impersonated, actually. Another storytelling example, look up what happened to Ferrari last year. They defended successfully against the social engineering attack because someone who was called by the alleged, I think, CFO again, asked them a verifying question as to what book recommendation they had given them the week before. And the attacker didn't know that what that book was, so the attack didn't succeed. Storytelling is massively powerful. You can, of course, argue with regulations again. Since they hold the board accountable and personally liable. And of course, what you can do to get buy-in is you can simply calculate the return on security investment, if you want to, or the return on investment, and show that it is very beneficial to invest into human risk management.
Yeah, and I think although regulation is, I guess one stick to beat them into submission and focus on it. That it's probably better to use a carrot with that storytelling, and I suppose it's really for CISOs to get that time with the exec teams and board to, as you say, bring the stories to life. To and again, that's just it's awareness, but then it creates that intent and understanding of what needs to be done, and then hopefully will trigger the question of actually how do I start implementing this. Brian, just if I come to you for the next question, what do you see as the biggest challenges? Sorry, what are the biggest challenges you see organizations facing when it comes to human security programs? And I guess that's, the implementation, the operation.
So employee engagement and motivation, there is a, a certain fatigue out there. So engaging in personalized content, tailored content, is crucial. And keeping, the fact that the content can sometimes get stale and not keep a pace with modern threats and evolution. So having a regular cadence, keeping up with the current threats, and also measuring progress and effectiveness. So good reporting and having the skills and resources to do all of that. So the same way, if you're investing in any technology or security program, that you need to make sure you don't just buy a tool, but also have the requisite resources. And if you don't have access to that, then consider, a partner or services to go alongside the technology as well to help you with all of that.
Yeah. So, Joe, we've got a couple more questions. I'll try and squeeze them in before we come up for the hour because we don't want to run too much long beyond that. So, a question is, how can we utilize what, well, John? This is hopefully a question you can answer, Martin. I appreciate you're the evangelist rather than technology expert. But how can we utilize KnowBe4 to address the risks related to recent tech evolution through trainings?
Right. So we've got training modules in there to cover generative AI, for example, large language models. We have got content in there specifically on deepfakes, and we have, always content in there even for secure development operations, if that's something your organization needs to have for in-house development and how to develop those securely.
Okay.
So that is without any further specification, like that is what I would say broadly.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I suppose that's the important aspect is making sure that that's up to date, and something that KnowBe4 does extremely well is making sure that everything's relevant. And actually, as Brian said in his last answer, that it's not stale, which is obviously a bit of a turn off to people completing their awareness training. So the last question we have here is with more and more systems gathering and storing security data, and now also a user behavior type data, at what point does the employee's privacy rights cross over with an organization's security risk position? Asked with systems that warn or alert based on system detected change in a user behavior pattern in mind. So it's quite a long a question there. If I just kind of break that down, probably that first piece, that monitoring people's behavior, does that step upon privacy rights? I suppose Germany being one of those that is very at the forefront of privacy.
It does. Of course, it does. Therefore, it's crucially important to look very closely what actually is happening on a technical level, and of course, to manage the perception of it. So, firstly, what do I mean when I say manage perception? I mean, whenever you do, and this is actually not a new challenge here, whenever you even do security awareness training in your organization, you will know to involve, if you have it, the Workers' Council, because you mentioned Germany. Of course, the UK also has them. But you will know to involve them. You will know to involve your legal department. You will know to involve your HR department. And generally speaking, the lawyers and the Workers' Council, they will work it out for you. I do have a privacy certification myself, so I'm not just saying that out of thin air. But I also don't want to get into the details. I will just say this is a standing problem that usually is solved where exactly privacy individual rights are weighed against the overall security interest of the organization in light of your employment contractual obligations. And usually that means that with the right policies and procedures in place, technical measures become permissible and the security of the organization can be improved through these interventions that we have been talking about. That is what it generally means, even in one of the probably most regulated countries when it comes to data protection, that Germany is.
Okay, very good. Joe, there's one last question that came in, but I think we'll answer that offline, particularly because it's got a real technical twist to it. And Martin,
I'm
not to
happy.
talk not to talk for yourself, but I think that's probably something that we line up one of the SEs to come back on, and we can follow up on that.
Exactly. I think that's the best way to address it. I can tell you that the defense agents does not sit on, the employee's computer at all. So we are not comparable to something that, your endpoint detection would do. And that means we're not running prone to risking something that happened to CrowdStrike when, the world saw what it means to have a kernel integration. So no worries about that. It's a very different concept, and our sales engineers will be very capable to answer that.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, I think that is it from us today. Just the last thing I wanted to just cover off is just some upcoming webinars. Very firstly, I think in September we have our AI risk management in practice, and we're bringing some of our experts in from a couple of areas across our business to talk around AI risk and how we can mitigate it. And that's really implementation of AI inside of our organizations. And then secondly, for those that don't speak or read Swedish, which is myself, but I'm aware that on the 16th of September, for our Swedish speakers, we have our webinar touching upon OT and how to secure OT. So please use the QR code there to register. And that brings me to my last task, which is just to say thank you. Thank you to our panelists. So thank you to Brian. Thank you to Martin for joining us and sharing your knowledge and expertise. And also thank you to everybody that's joined. Thank you very much.